Here we go. Okay, everyone. So we are doing the last two chapters. We're at the pivot point in the McGill's essay, literally the very exciting moment. So I'm going to summarize in about 65 seconds what happened in the first chapters, and then everybody's going to be rocking and rolling for the second chapters. Very simply, we have protagonists of Elimelech and Naomi. They have two children, Mahlon and Chilion. There's a famine. They leave from Beit Lechem. They travel to Moab. Tragically, Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion die. Before they die, they marry Rut. Mahlon marries Rut, and as well as Orpah marries Chilion. Tragedy strikes the family. Dad dies. The two husbands die. And then we have an elderly Naomi who hears that the famine is over in Beit Lechem in Jerusalem, which is only 5 miles south of modern-day Jerusalem. And they start heading back. And she tries to dissuade the two her two daughters-in-law, like, hey, I got nothing for you. I got no more sons. And even as she says, even if I would be with a man tonight and I'll get pregnant, would you wait 20 years before you can marry my children again? No, move on. So Orpah hears that and she says, you know something? You're right. But of course, we have the dramatic scene at the end of chapter one where Ruth says, wherever you go, I will go. Your God is my good. Your people are my people. And she says, I'm with you. I'm all in. I'm doing the Jewish thing. I'm all in. And they go to Beit Lechem. Now, obviously, Naomi goes back to their ancestral land, their ancestral home, but they don't have any men to really work the field. And basically, they're in a state of poverty. Ruth looks in the fridge, not a whole lot going on there. She says, shall I go out to the field and do some gleaning, which is go and pick up the barley? And she says, yes, you do. She, of course, serendipitously or providentially, shall we say, shows up at the field of none other than the distant relative, Boaz. And he takes a liking to her. She says, you're a great person. You did many kindnesses to your mother-in-law. Stay in my field through the barley season and the wheat season, and she comes and meanwhile, so the next basically 2 months, she's bringing home the food from Boaz's fields. And now get to a dramatic scene, and I'm going to share the screen, and here we go. Showtime at the Apollo. Here we go. So all right. So Shayna, since you have a few minutes, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit. All right. So the lesson we're going to look at: Thou shalt be chutzpahdik. Okay, let's take it away.
Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "Shall I not seek repose for you so that it will be well with you?"
Okay,
Now,
repose. Okay, hold this out. Repose is a fancy language change. I want to see you. The Hebrew word is menucha, which is kind of, she wants you to have, she wants her to be settled in life. Okay? Hint, hint, marriage, go on.
is not Boaz our relative with whose maidens you were? Behold, he is winnowing barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash, anoint, and put on your garments and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he finishes eating and drinking. When he lies down, take note of the place where he lies, and you shall come and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what you shall do. She said to her, all that you say to me, I shall do.
Our
She
pause
went.
right there. Okay, now, if you just read these first five verses, what is Naomi seemingly telling Ruth to do?
Seduce him.
Yes, Robin on the money. So, in our basically, if you just stop the movie at this particular point, I mean, in other words, you can, in other words, if Naomi wants to bring the family together, wouldn't you have a date like during the earlier evening? Not at, in other words, things that happen after midnight, go, by the way, notice what it says, wash, anoint yourself, put on your, in other words, get all glitzed up, whatever that was in the time of the Shoftim, it's the same, and then slide into the threshing, in other words, be, this is, slide into the granary, nobody's around, and of course, and he lies down, of course, he's all alone. Right now, you're gonna imagine basically he's telling her, she's telling Ruth, basically, seduce your relative Boaz. That's what you, okay. I mean, is that, I mean, I think Robin's reading is that's otherwise, why don't they have the meeting or the conversation? Why don't they invite them over for dinner? Have Naomi there, have Ruth there, have Boaz there, and have a schmooze. No schmoozing. Get all decked up in the middle of the night, go into the granary, slide next to Boaz, uncover his feet, and he'll tell you what you shall do. That doesn't sound too modest. That is what I call a unmodest proposal. Okay? So let's see where this house goes. Keep on going, Shayna.
She went down to the threshing floor and did all that her mother-in-law commanded her. Boaz ate and drank and was in good spirits, and he went to lie at the edge of the pile of grain. She came secretly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, the man trembled and twisted around, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I am Ruth, your handmaid. May you spread the corner of your garment over your handmaid, for you are a redeemer."
Okay. All right. Wow. Okay. So now, what is she asking? What is she asking? There's a lot of layers here, so we got to unpack this piece by what was she? She did proposition him, but not to have a one night stand there in the edge of the in the granary. What did she ask him to do?
To cover her.
Yeah, so obviously she's using some poetic language. In other words, there's two phrases. May you spread the corner of your garment over your handmaid. What does that mean? Well, what could that mean? Let's unpack that carefully. I mean, just, and by the way, I'm going to give you guys a hint. If anybody goes to a Sephardic wedding under the chuppah before the Shel Brachos are said, before the Kiddushin is done, what does the Chatan do? He does something. Ashkenazim do not do this, but Sephardic men do, and also Yekke men, or German Jewish men do.
Do
They, I
they?
know,
I think they wrap their wife under their tallit with them.
they put on a tallis, and then they wrap him and her under the tallis. Okay, well, what is that all about? What is that indicating? What does it mean that, and by the way, the source of that practice is this one sentence. Okay, now I've given it away. What was she basically telling him? It's a two-word request.
Marry me.
Marry me. Now, you're talking, okay, I mean, how gutsy is this? Now, in our day, if you go online, is it proper for a woman to ask a guy out? There's back and forth. How about a woman go in the middle of the night and say to a guy, "Will you marry me?" Okay. I mean, on the chutzpahometer, where would you put that? 0 to 10. I mean, they knew each other. It wasn't, they were they he had been working in her field for 3 or 4 months, and he knew that she had spoken very glowingly about her. But is that what I mean on the chutzpahometer? I mean, how daring is this?
In those days, super daring. In the modern age, it's becoming more.
No, I don't know of anybody who goes up to a woman. I mean, a woman goes up to a guy and on the first that says, "By the way, will you marry me?"
No, not on the first date, but women proposing to the man is becoming more commonplace.
Okay, but still, on the first date, that's a whole lot. That's a whole lot of thing. All right, Robin. Robin wants to say, get on it. Yeah.
Okay, here's the thing. Okay, there's this great juxtaposition of what their positions are in life. And I think that it's actually really complicated because if you think about it, she says, "I am Ruth, your handmaid." Okay.
Yes.
But at the same time, Boaz is her redeemer. He's like the equivalent of like the Piloni alimony that was mentioned,
Later,
in
later, later on, next chapter.
exactly. And so, when he says, well, I mean, later on he says, like, let's look for someone else before, I'm your
Well, no,
guy.
because he's second in line. We're going to get to that. You're going ahead of the story. Don't
Sorry. Sorry.
spoil the story.
But here's the thing. If you think about it, here's this woman who really is status wise beneath him.
Correct.
And yet she does this very almost brave, noble thing by saying, I'm in her own way, I'm putting us on an equal playing field here because I need you.
Yes.
And I think that there's something complicated yet beautiful about it, because almost like, okay, so like if you're taking the idea of the garment, okay, on one hand, there's the physical, which is you can cover me with this and again redeem my modesty. But there's also the idea of you can protect me.
Right. That's what it is. It's really the protection thing. He's saying two things. So I just want to separate that. So, Robin, in other words, that makes it even more dramatic because, in other words, on one hand, she as she's a convert, she's a foreigner, she has a lower status. She worked as basically a person as a poor person picking up stray leftover sheaves in the thing. And yet she's saying, marry me. And two, here's your redeemer. I want you to buy my husband and Naomi and my father-in-law's ancestral land, which is a safety net, which is mentioned in the Torah, that if a person hits rock bottom, the relative, the close relative, should redeem them by buying their property and ideally allowing them to remain on it as well. Kaylee, you had a question.
Just a comment, and I guess it's part of a question, but it's interesting that Naomi tells Ruth to go lie down, and then she says he will tell you what to do. But when Ruth has a chance to do something, she's the one that actually initiates the conversation. So it's
Correct.
Almost like Naomi was telling her, just put yourself in the position so that he will do what he wants with you. But Ruth is kind of taking that power back and saying, you know, I'm here, but I'm asking you something.
Right. So I don't know necessarily that, you know, Naomi Godfrey was trying to, quote unquote, pimp her out, just, you know, but he may have was certainly suggesting for May perhaps take a more passive role. Let him lead the, in other words, take the hint, you know, I mean, do the old uncover the feet hint, and he'll let him figure it out. Now, she took the wheel here. I'm Ruth, your handmaid. Spread your corner of your garment over your hand. I mean, and you are the redeemer. So she's asking for two things: marry me, and basically provide myself and my family financial security. That's one heck of a sentence. Okay. From that, the Ralbag points out, this is in the Hebrew, they don't know English translation, I'll just paraphrase it, saying that we learn from Ruth, that a person should be kitsat azut, for the word, a person should be brazen in order to not lose the good because they're too embarrassed. Sometime in life, guys, this is an important lesson. You got to find your inner Ruth. There are moments will happen in your life where you're going to be, if you want to get your desired end, you need to step out of your comfort zone, and you got to be a little brazen. You got to be a little pushy. You got to be a little shovey. You got to step up to the plate, because in life, if you do not ask, general, you do not get. And to quote Hamilton, she was not going to throw away her shot, guys. This is her shot. She wasn't going to throw away her shot. This is it. And even if it meant, now, what could have happened? He could have said, no. I mean, talking about the possibility of massive rejection over here, this could have gone like, sweetie, you're a wonderful person. But first of all, how old is Boaz?
He's old.
He's old. According to the Midrash, he's 80. How old is Ruth? She's 40. No, she's been married for 10 years. No, she's not. So, you know, she's, but 40, a 40-year-old woman and an 80-year-old man. I mean, you know, it does happen, but, you know, whatever. He could have said no. Now, so basically the Rabbag points out that if there's an opportunity for get your achieved good, to achieve what you need to achieve, you don't give away your shot because you feel shy and timid. Gotta, as I said, thou shalt be chutzpahdik, where it's appropriate. Okay, let's keep on going. Lesson two.
Rabbi, Dad, I want to say Shada. Good night and calling to you next week. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, all the best. Okay, so we continue. Now, lesson two, we learn another lesson from this. Who is the true hero? One who conquers his passions. This is the Targum. The Targum is the Aramaic translation. Now, the Aramaic translation of the Megill root actually weaves in a number of Midrashic components. And I'll just say this. So I'm just going to go right from the Aramaic right to the English. And it was in the middle of the night, and behold, to the man, and the man was shocked, and his flesh like got goose pimples from the fear, because he didn't know who just came in. I mean, remember, it's in the middle of the night, the place is dark, and suddenly this person comes in, and he might decide he's going to die, and then he sees a woman. Sit by his feet. Then he adds the midrashic element. Ukvash yitre, and he held back his passion, his desires. Desires for what, ladies and gentlemen? Let me put into some contemporary terms. What happens if a beautiful woman, who is all full of wearing her very finest clothes, makeups, in a very elegant way, basically slides into your bed. What? This is for the men in the house. What nisayon, what trial, what challenge does that provide a guy? What's a guy going to do? What a guy usually has to go out and find the woman. Women do not tend to slide into one's bed. That's not how it works in the reality. Okay. So when that would happen, what would the Medrash say is going to be the next step for Boaz? Scott Shapiro, calling you out, baby. What do you imagine should be the next scene?
That he accepts and they get married.
No, not married. No, just saying, basically, if he just, in other words, before she said anything, she just there, what would he expect you to do if you had a beautiful woman to show up in your bed?
Base desires.
Yeah. You would have, you would say, well, hello, you know what I mean? They'd have a one night stand. So the Medrash says, Kvash Yitzre, he held back his passion and he did not touch her. Just in the same way that Yosef, the righteous one, who refused to approach the Egyptian wife of his master. And like another one, Paltiel ben Bar, son of Laish, who was a great man, a righteous person, who did not, who also refrained from sleeping with Michal, the daughter of Shaul, who was the wife of King David. Two situations of men who had the opportunity to have women who wanted to sleep with them, but said no. It was an act of what they call, the Hebrew is Kfishat Hayetzer, as Pirkei Avos says, who is mighty, Hakomish is Yitro. So basically, this was a big challenge for Boaz, right? If some woman, gorgeous woman, slides into your bed at night, this McGill is not going to become an R-rated film. I mean, you know what I'm saying? We don't have to use any imagination, right? That's baby X, you know what I'm saying? So the Midrash expressed in the Targum gives Boaz a lot of credit. Let's continue the story. I'm going to call upon Kayla. Read it out if you can. This is his response. Verse 10.
He said, "Blessed are you to Hashem, my daughter. This last kindness is better than the first, that you have not gone after the young men, be they poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not be afraid. All that you say, I shall do for you. For all that pass by the gate of my people, know that you are a woman of valor. Now, though it is true that I am a redeemer, there is a redeemer who is closer than I. Stay the night, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem. But if he does not want to redeem you, as God lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning."
Okay. So what is the gesture of honor, and I'm going to use the Hebrew word menschlichkeit, just being a mensch over here. How did he handle Ruth at a moment of, in a certain sense, absolute vulnerability here. How does he sort of turn the conversation and turn the situation, which was obviously very awkward, vulnerable? He turns the conversation all 180 degrees. How does he do it?
I mean, he gives her such great comfort. And not only that, but he's putting her in a position where she will not be embarrassed because, let's say, and keeping her safe all the while, because he's saying, stay the night. And like, he wouldn't want to embarrass her and cast her aside or put her in danger of going out and, God forbid, somebody either saying something or attacking her, you know? Right. And so he says, in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem. But if he does not want to redeem you, as God lives, I will redeem you. So he's saying, we're not done yet. We're gonna figure out what the right thing is together. So he's not leaving her alone in this.
And no matter what, you are gonna be taken care of. You're gonna, in other words, you're gonna get what you want. And then let's unpack the he says. He starts off with a praise. First of all, he empties out the situation of the sexual charge nature of the atmosphere. How does he change, which was initially, as Robin identified, as a night of seduction, and he changes the tone dramatically? How does he do that? In verse 10, he does that in a very eloquent way.
He tells her how blessed she is.
So now, but how is he relating to her? He calls her, blessed are you to Hashem, my daughter. Now, obviously, I mean, that means he's relating to her in a very, as a caring father, not a creepy guy going to sleep on a, preying on a vulnerable young woman guy. Okay. So he said, and then your last kindness is better than your first. So the first kindness was how she took care of her mother-in-law. Basically, she could have remained in Moab and lived the life of Riley, as they say, but she accompanied, took care of her. And this last kindness. Now, what he says, that you have not gone after the young men, be they poor or rich. He's giving her a massive compliment. What's the matter? He's giving her a huge compliment. What's the compliment that he's given her? That you've not gone after the young men, be they poor or rich.
Last kindness is better than the first. Oh, well.
Moshe Chaim?
I mean, it seems backhanded that you're not a gold digger. You're not pursuing someone for looks or money.
No, no, it's... What should Ruth have done if she's moved to Beit Lechem as being a woman, I don't know if she's somewhere between 30 and 40 years old, after being a widow? She should have
married
somebody closer to her age. Now, clearly, by marrying somebody who's 80, I'm sure maybe Boaz was good looking, but still, she's giving up a big chunk of her romantic life. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to understand why she's doing that. But he's saying, you could have gone for, and it seems that, a person would rather marry somebody their own age, whether they, certainly if they're rich, but even if they're poor. And you're giving that up because you, for some reason, you want to be married, which will be fully exposed next, will be fully understood next chapter. Okay? So, now, by the way, the principle here is a man must be big enough to admit his mistakes, smart enough to profit from them, and strong enough to correct them. Okay, basically, we finish off the story in chapter 2. Boaz said to her, "May Hashem take care of you." What does it mean when somebody says, "May Hashem take care of you"? What is implicit in that? The old Jerry Seinfeld joke at end of a date. Take care. What is the person really saying?
Goodbye.
Good luck. You're on your own.
Yeah, you're on your own. Or take care. In other words, you should take care because I'm not going to. Mm-hmm. So when he said in eloquent say in the last chapter, may Hashem take care of you, was he being really a good relative?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, did he open his field? Was he generous with her? Yes. But when the season, harvest season was over, you know, he wasn't the first redeemer. It's true. But he said, may Hashem take care of you. Which implies that what?
I won't.
Not my problem. So here, he's accepting implicitly, you know, we're going to take care. Either the Redeemer close to you will take care of you and your and Naomi financially and will marry you, or I will. We'll just see. Okay? So this is like a little bit of a tshuva moment. Let's keep on going. We're cruising. We're finishing up chapter 3. We're going to chapter 4. Okay, so Rob, do you want to read B'vakasha, verse 14?
Yes. She lay at his feet until the morning, and she rose before one could recognize his fellow. He said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. He said, bring the shawl that is upon you and hold it. She held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and placed it upon her. He came to the city. She came to her mother-in-law. She said, who are you, my daughter? She told her all that the man had done for her. She said, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, do not come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter will fall, for the man will not rest, but will conclude the matter today.
Exactly. So here's a principle. Treat the vulnerable with dignity and love the convert. In other words, just to pick up a thing that Robin pointed out in the earlier thing, he told her to stay the night because for her to cast her aside in the middle of the night would be A, you know, it's a rejection. B, could be, you know, maybe it'll be embarrassing if she gets seen. And lastly, she could be subject to physical attack. He says, first of all, notice he says, I want you to bring back this very, you know, very generous amount of grain. But notice, he doesn't give her the grain. Why does he give her the grain? He says, give it back to your mother-in-law. Why is that more dignified?
So she actually has some, first of all, it's a kindness to Naomi.
Yep.
And then also because it's sort of like she went there, she received a gift. And instead, it wasn't just there's this seduction. There wasn't this hookup. There was actual proof that she stayed there in a dignified fashion.
Right. And also he's saying, I'm not making you into a pauper. Now, obviously, there's only 2 women in the household. There's Naomi and there is Ruth. So obviously, the food that he's giving to her mother-in-law, she's also going to get. But she didn't want her to feel like a poor person. Right. She's actually going to be the emissary of giving a nice gift to her mother-in-law. Which is again more dignified, and the mother-in-law said he's the kind of guy. The fact that he went out into the city means that he is going to take care of the problem. He's not going to like, all right, I'll get to it. You know, we all have people who are like, yeah, I'll take care of it, and they never do. First thing, the first light of morning, boom, he's taking care of business over here. TCB, taking care of business. That is what Boaz is doing. Okay, we now transition to the fourth and last chapter. Now, this is something which is we're going to get into. Let us, all right, Kayla, read it out. Verse 1, chapter 4.
Boaz went up to the gate and sat there. And behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz spoke passed. And he said, turn aside, sit here, so-and-so. And he turned aside and sat. He took 10 men from the elders of the city, and he said, sit here. And they sat. He said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who returned from the fields of Moab, sold the portion of the field that belongs to our brother, to Elimelech. I thought I would inform you of it, saying, buy it before those sitting here and before the leaders of my nation. If you will redeem it, redeem it. And if he will not redeem it, tell me that I may know, for there is none besides you to redeem it, and I come after you.
All right, so the translation is called Sosa, but the Hebrew, as Robin alluded to, in other words, saying like John Doe, you know, when they have those pictures of like a fake identity. So the Hebrew thing is called Ploni Almoni, which they translate so-and-so, which means like John Doe. You know, it's like the generic non-name name. Okay. So she says, you're the redeemer. And she wants to sell the field of Elimelech's plot to you. And what does he say? He says, I'll redeem it. I'm in. Oh, which means is I'm going to pony up the cash, buy the field. Naomi will have the resources in which to do what she needs to do. And they'll probably let her stay on the land as well. So it's, keep on going. Verse 5.
Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabite, you have bought the wife of the dead to establish the name of the deceased on his inheritance.
Whoa! Slap in a little curveball. In addition to this portion of land, there is an additional addendum which I need to share with you. A little tiny condition. If you choose to buy this property, there's a bonus track included. And that is that you are to marry, you bought the wife of the dead. In other words, you're going to marry Ruth to establish the name of the, in other words, to basically, the goal is to keep the name of Mahlon, that's her late husband, alive still on that day, associated with that, with their ancestral land. Okay, so that was like the little kicker. Well, all right, so shall we say, change in the deal. Let's see how he says, verse 6.
The Redeemer said, I will not be able to redeem lest I destroy my inheritance. You take my redemption rights for yourself, for I will not be able to redeem it.
Okay, stop right there. So he says, well, with an additional caveat, what do you mean it will destroy my inheritance? So there are many mephorshim that, give a number of possibilities. But what do you think? Give me some possibilities on your own reading. Why do you think he would not want to bring perhaps the 35-year-old something Moabite wife into his mishpacha? Add the second wife into the old family. Well, what pray tell could be an issue with that?
Family drama would cause them.
Yes, that would basically saying that's what Rashi brings up. It's going to explode my house. You know what I mean? Like, guys, kids, honey, something happened downtown. We need to have a conversation. Let's just say that our family grew. And I want to introduce you to our distant relative. Remember Mahlon? Remember Mahlon? Yeah, this was his wife. And now she is, as a gesture, as a kind of yibum, a Levirate marriage, I have married her. How would that go around the Shabbos? How would that information go down on the old Shabbos table?
Is he married already?
Yeah, he's married. He has. In order to destroy my inheritance means he'd say, as Kayla, one reading is basically destroy my family. Yeah, because that's going to be or either also there's a yichus thing. She's a convert. She's from Moab. It's also maybe embarrassing. There could be all kinds of association there. Either intrinsically in the family dynamic, it's like adding an extra wife can be complicated. And whatever the thing is, he says, I can't do it. It was not a financial issue. I can't do it. Okay? So Ploni Almoni says, I decline. And now the ball is passed to none other than Boaz. He's tag, you're it. You're the next redeemer. Let's see how it goes. Yeah, verse 7.
This was the custom in earlier times in Israel regarding the redemption and the exchange. To establish any matter, one would take off his shoe and give it to the other. And this was the manner of ratification in Israel.
Okay, so pause like this. So this is more of actually a halachic point. If you go to a wedding, a Jewish wedding, and you go to where the chassans, what they call the chassans dish, the chassans table, you will see the rabbi will tell the chatan all the ramifications of the ketubah, which basically lists all his responsibility to his wife, and he will hand her a handkerchief or a kippah or a pen. He takes it and lifts it up. But back then, instead of a handkerchief, kippah, or pen, they literally took a shoe, and he passed the shoe to the other guy, made it very clear it's basically a demonstration that he's accepting responsibility. You're doing a discernible act of accepting responsibility. Okay? That's what they did. Boaz said, go on, verse 9.
Boaz said to the elders and all of the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Kilion and Mahlon from the hand of Naomi. And also Ruth, the Moabite wife of Mahlon, I have bought for myself as a wife to establish the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased shall not be cut off from his brothers and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses today.
Okay. So what we have to understand is Naomi and Ruth are committed to marry into Mahlon's family, essentially. Nor Boaz is the closest redeemer relative who is really, was basically Mahlon's uncle, essentially. And, what would be so terrible if Ruth would have said, look, Mom, I love you. And, Naomi, I'm with you. But there's some nice guys here in Beit Lechem, and I'll marry them. And, and I'm a Jewish woman now, and that's a Jewish guy, and we're going to have a Jewish home. And whenever it's Mahlon's yard site, we'll have a get together. Why is she going specifically trying to keep the name of Mahlon alive? And you can make a further argument. Was he such a great guy? Clearly he died young. He left, Israel. I mean, it doesn't seem to be the most spectacular character in all of Tanakh. Why is she, she's giving up a lot to do this. And also Boaz, but I would say much more Ruth. So, as they say in Yiddish, let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Okay? So the question is, Mahlon, he's a good guy. I'm sure he was a loving husband. He died. They had the mourning, the Avelis. Move on. She's not moving on. And apparently she's committed to to marry back, sort of like basically to marry sort of a Mahlon substitute or somebody that's related to Mahlon to keep his, as Boaz says, so that the name of the deceased shall not be cut off from his brothers from the gate of his place. You are witnesses today. So Boaz is also into it. And this is viewed as a very, and not only that, he's doing it in front of 10 elders of the city. You know what I mean? It's like a very big deal. This is what's the necessity for this? What do you guys got to say? Moshe Chaim Doe is going to take a stab at it. Go ahead.
I'll take a stab. I mean, I can only think about family inheritance in Israel, and that keeping kind of in the tribe and the family is one of the things that you're supposed to do, and that you're not supposed to sell off the land, basically, or give it away.
No, so first of all, you are correct. But if Ruth would have just sold it to, just imagine that Naomi, as the inheritor of her husband's land, sold it to Boaz, the land would have been kept in the family. Boaz is the uncle. So they're in the mishpacha. They're going a step further. They have the land, and then they're going to have this relationship, which is sort of like a reenactment of the Mahlon-Ruth marriage on the same plot of land, on their ancestral land. What's going on here? I'm short on time, so I want to finish at 9 o'clock because that's my rule. I want to keep it under the hour mark. The basic idea is like this, that a Jewish family has, every Jewish family has, stands for certain values and virtues and traditions. Okay? In other words, we have a concept in Judaism called the Mesora, the tradition, midor lador, from one generation to the other. In other words, that parents teach their children certain values, and that generation has to teach it on to the next generation. Okay? So the point is that Mahlon, by the way, what was Mahlon's role in the life of Ruth in the first 10 years of her relationship? What did Mahlon do for Ruth in the first 10 years of their marriage? And remember, Ruth came into this relationship as a non-Jew. So Mahlon basically was Ruth's first Torah teacher. She brought her into Judaism. She taught her about the ways of Hashem. There's a whole debate. Did they get converted fully initially? Was there a partial conversion? Did she convert only later? There's a whole debate about that. But it's clearly the Jewish ways. Who took on that role after Mahlon died? Well, that was Naomi. So basically, Ruth wants to continue on the values, the legacy of the house of Mahlon and what it stood for. It was tragic that it was cut short. And by marrying his relative, they are going to be able to continue the legacy of the values, of the virtues, of what they stood for to the next generation. You know, it's not perfect, but life is rarely perfect. So that's what she's doing it for. And she's willing to give up. She's not marrying somebody who's her old age. She's marrying somebody, you know, a lot older. So, and Rashi says, since his wife goes and comes to the estate and brings in and takes that item, people say, oh, this is Mahlon's wife. And therefore, his wife is remembered upon it. In other words, Rashi's saying, how is it going to be remembered? People, oh, who's that girl? Oh, yeah, that used to be Mahlon's wife, now married to Boaz. So again, Mahlon and what he stood for is always going to be, he's not going to be forgotten. Okay? So that's that. Now we have lesson five. Keep on going, Caleb. Keep on going. He's got a few more verses here.
All the people at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May Hashem make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and like Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephrat, and may your name be renowned in Beit Lechem. May your house be like the house of Peretz, whom Tamar bore to Yehuda through the offspring that Hashem will give you from this maiden.
Okay. So now the fact that the elder said that your household should be like Rachel and Leah, what is that really saying about this household? If you say something, well, we have the blessing, it should be like Rachel and Leah. What is that really saying? She should become like what?
Holy.
Right. Holy. Like basically being the ultimate Jew, you know, the ultimate Jewish heroine. And interesting, Rabbi Yosef Kara, who was a contemporary of Rashi, he says that in a certain sense, just like Rachel and Leah, Rachel and Leah's father was Lavan. Lavan was an idolater. Yaakov married them and even said converted them in a sense and married them and brought them to the ideas of Hashem. And you're going to do the very same thing with Ruth and don't feel bad. And connecting it to Tamar. Now, Tamar is another story of Tamar is the daughter-in-law of Yehuda. Yehuda gave him the first two sons. They died young and didn't want to give him the third son, Shelah. And Tamar dressed up as a prostitute, as you remember, and slept with Yehuda. And then gave birth to Peretz. Okay? So that was another example of a woman who wanted to continue to be part of the house of Yehuda, to continue on the building the Jewish people, and did it in an unconventional way. And they should partake of this as well. Now, here's the key point. What are they really saying? See, and you may hear the words, oh, that person, they have great yichus. The word yichus means coming from a distinguished family. The whole Megillah at Ruth, what is more important, coming from a distinguished family or being a great person? Did Ruth have great yichus? Did she have great genealogy? Did she come from a distinguished family?
Yes.
No, she did not. She came from a pagan.
Oh, well, that's...
Ruth, Boaz did. Ruth came, was a convert. She comes from idolaters. But they're telling her that that's not important. What does Boaz himself call her? Two words, which becomes here. Her great grandson wrote an entire poem about this. Two words. How is Ruth called in the Megillah? The best comment you can give a woman.
Ishus Chayil.
Ishus Chayil. You're a woman of valor. But why is she a woman of valor? Because she is kind, she is confident, she is compassionate, she cares about people, she's willing to do this dramatic thing to keep the name of the family alive. This is a very virtuous woman. But she may not come from, she comes from very humble stock. She came from a pagan father. But the key point is that ultimately, yichus is an indicator of greatness, but it's not a substitute for greatness. And everybody, what your past is irrelevant. The future starts right now and with you. And everybody has the opportunity to find within themselves their qualities and build upon them to be the best version of themselves. Ruth came from the most humblest background, and she, as we're going to soon see, becomes the grandmother of King David. Let's continue on. Yeah, verse 13. Let's keep on going.
Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. He came to her, and Hashem granted her conception, and she bore a son. The women said to Naomi, "Blessed is Hashem who did not keep a redeemer from you. May his name be renowned in Israel. May he be for you one who revives life, and to support you in old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has bore him." And Naomi took the boy and placed him in her bosom, and she became his nurse.
Okay. Why does it say that the little boy is to Naomi one who revives life? Why is this little baby boy a reviver of Naomi, his grandmother, a reviver of her life?
She loses her whole family, and, you know, she loses her husband, she loses her two children. And when she was leaving, well, when she came back, she said, my soul is dark.
Yeah. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. Call me bitter.
Right.
I left full. I'm empty.
Correct. But, and so, but then here's this, she gains so much back. You know, she has this young woman in her life that dedicates her being to her.
For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a lesson. Here's a lesson. Lesson seven. In Hashem's world, your reward might come when you least expect it. If you had interviewed Naomi as she walked into Beit Lechem earlier that year, depressed, sad, poor, with her Moabite, newly converted woman, Ruth. And basically, she says, "I'm empty." She was despondent, and now she's now financially secure. She now has a child who basically is a incarnated version of her son Mahlon, or she has a grandchild that she never had, and she has family that were all, as Robin pointed out, were all taken away from her. Now she's restored. And that's what the Rav Yosef Arama says. First of all, number one is, how is that child going to make her thing? Because when you hold a cute baby, even if you're feeling depressed, as Moshe Chaim was holding his 11-month-old child, you have a little baby to hold, even if it's not your own. It makes it lifts you. It lifts you. It gives you a little gives chizuk. And again, she can now have a future. Let's finish it off. Verse 17. Let's finish it off. We've got 4 to 5 minutes left. Keep on going.
The neighbors named him, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Oved. He is the father of Yishai, the father of David. These are the descendants of Peretz. Peretz fathered Chetzron, and Chetzron fathered Ram, and Ram fathered Aminadav, and Aminadav fathered Nachshon, and Nachshon fathered Shlama, and Thelma fathered Boaz, and Boaz fathered Oved, and Oved fathered Yishai, and Yishai fathered David.
Okay, so clearly, the Megillah is teaching us that Judah, who Yaakov Avinu said is going to have the scepter, is going to have kingship, is the direct line from Judah to King David, whose descendant is going to be the King Mashiach, has a critical junction. Who is that juncture? Ruth. Ruth, King David's grandparents is Boaz and Ruth. And now we understand why we basically that the the qualities of the king, the leader of the Jewish people, back of King David, ultimately in the Melech Mashiach, is the Ruth and Boaz people. Qualities of chesed, qualities of being bold, quality of doing the right thing, even if it's not easy, being wise, being sensitive, all the good qualities that we identified, and there are more, that Boaz and Ruth showed, are the inheritance for King David. Not doing the conventional thing, but getting the job done anyways. So dealing with it, overcoming adversity is a story of Ruth. You know, and finding unusual manners to solve problems that on the surface seem insolvable. This is the story of Ruth, and this is the story of Boaz, and this is the story of King David. And that basically is it fits in nicely for Shavuos, because Shavuos is going to be, we get to receive the Torah. The Melech Mashiach job is to bring the Torah, not just to the Jewish people, but to humanity at large. And what quality? It's interesting. Comes from a convert. Person who helped make this a reality was not Jewish. Ruth was a Moabite. She was not Jewish. Yet she saw the value in Judaism, and she followed, she said, your people are my people. Your God is my God. Wherever you go, I will go. And she really, with her greatness as being the Eishes Chayil of epic proportions, sacrificed much, but really brought to the world King David, and ultimately, God willing, in our day, the Melech HaMashiach. And this is a there's a lot to learn about what Jewish leadership is all about. Comes from a woman who was not Jewish. Okay, so we do not look down at anybody, and obviously, and just the opposite. A person who converts for the right reason, we have to extol, and we have to be sensitive. We have to take care of that people, because that person is extremely special. How special? The progenitor of the King Messiah themselves. So there's a lot to unpack. This is really sort of like a helicopter ride through the last three chapters, two chapters. If you want to, we did the first two chapters last week. It's already up on Yutara. And any questions? All right.
Yeah.
Wait, okay, Robin.
Go, Robin, first.
Sorry. Did you have a question?
No, sorry. Thank you.
So when we were talking about Ruth and her and whether or not she came from humble beginnings or not, I think that her start with Naomi was humble, but she was a Moabite princess.
So according to the Midrash, that Orpah and Ruth were the daughters of Eglon. Eglon was the king of Moab. So they were princesses. They were politically great, but as far as their stature, they were idolaters. So mm-hmm. from that perspective, they were not. I mean, they were. You know, she and even she. And the truth is, she says, "I'm your handmaid. I'm a humble servant." You know, part of her point is that even if she came from political power, she already recognized that really a person's worth is not about what your political stature is, mm-hmm. is really the state of your soul. And she said, I'm just starting out here. You know what I mean? I've been Jewish for about 11 minutes here. So I got a journey to go, but she went to, but in a short amount of time, she became like one of the best Jews of all time. I mean, we don't call it Megillas Boaz. Okay. We don't call it Megillas Naomi. We really don't call it Megillas Mahlon. That's for sure. We call it Megillas Ruth, because she is the rock star that allowed the Jewish people to go so much higher. I want to wish everybody a Chag Sameach, a good Yontif, all the very best. And some of you I'll see you tomorrow night at MJE. All the best.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.